The Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129 presents America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture with Father Matt Malone and Carrie Weber.
Good day. You're listening to America This Week, a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. I am Carrie Weber, executive editor for America Magazine.
And I am Ashley McKinless, sitting in for Father Matt Malone. Each week, we offer the news and analysis from the intersection of the church and the world, gathered by the team at America Magazine.
And one of the members of that team is here with us today, Colleen Dully. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Another voice we have here, thankfully, is our own Kevin Clark, who is a senior editor for America and who has recently, thankfully, returned from Iraq. And we're going to be speaking with him about that experience there. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Thanks for having me. Sorry to waste all that insurance money.
Company. Good. Started off with some
with all my limbs.
Really wonderful humor. Thank you, Kevin. So tell us a little bit about why you thought you wanted to go to Iraq. You know, we hear a lot of the stories. There's people, larger, you know, media outlets reporting from there. But you felt, and America felt, it was important to send someone there from our team.
Well, you know, we talked about that a bit, about whether it made sense for someone from staff to go or to try to find a local war correspondent who was familiar with quite literally the terrain and how to be safe in a war zone and to report from a war zone. And the more I talked to the folks at the Nineveh Reconstruction Committee, who helped coordinate my visit there, they actually encouraged me to come. First of all, they said, you know, it's not as dangerous, believe it or not, as people might think. They've been in, several of their representatives have been in out of Mosul, not on a regular basis, but they have done it.
And is that where you spend most of your time?
No, actually, I was only in Mosul for a day, which is probably the most potentially dangerous place to be. But they thought it would be encouraging to the Christians to see that a fellow Christian, a Catholic, was coming to visit them and learn about what they've been experiencing so that they understood that they weren't completely forgotten, because a lot of them have that sense that the West, the United States, Europe, has moved on. We're distracted by bigger problems. Even in that region, there are bigger problems have evolved in the last few years in Syria. Afghanistan remains a giant problem. And so Iraq and the fate of the Christians in Nineveh, which was sort of the homeland of all the Christians in Iraq, seems to have fallen from the headlines, and they're aware of that, and it bothers them tremendously.
When you say the Christians, what are we talking about here in terms of numbers?
Well, that's a debatable topic. The optimists like to say there's something like 250 to 300,000. Some say 350,000 Christians left in the Nineveh, all of Iraq, and particularly in Nineveh. More realistic numbers I heard were anywhere between 90 to 150,000.
And that's now, down from how many in recent decades?
I believe Iraq has a total population of around 27 million. In their better years, the Christians represented about 2 million, mm-hmm. over 2 million of that population. So they were a significant minority, and now they're down to being a tenth of what they were.
And what's driving them from the country?
Well, lately it's been the threat of ISIS, the existential threat that ISIS represented. In 2014, ISIS swept across the Nineveh Plains, driving Christians from their communities one after another. They had counted on the Peshmerga to protect them, which is the Kurdish, the army of the militia of the Kurdish people. They had been occupying that area. The Iraqi central government had completely withdrawn, so there was no one really counting on them doing much to protect or defend. But the Peshmerga had vowed to do so. Unfortunately, when ISIS began their assault, the Peshmerga were either outmaneuvered, outnumbered. There's still a lot of there's still a lot of suspicions about that. Whether I don't know if I should. Well, I guess I can share them here. The people were suggesting that there might have been a deal cut with the Peshmerga and ISIS. At any rate, the Peshmerga fell back and abandoned these Christian towns, and people literally had hours, some people had minutes, to get out. It wasn't clear what ISIS would do, whether if they would just kill people outright or force people to live under attacks or convert to Islam, They for some people who did not get away, it was sort of that convert or die problem, and some people died. A lot of the old people refused to leave or could not leave, and they were left behind. I think initially a lot of people thought, well, it'll be a couple of days, so we'll be home soon. It turned out to be 3-4 years for most people. Parents, grandparents were never seen again. Mm-hmm. That, you know, people thought we could come back in a few days and check on them. That proved to be impossible. It's not clear if they were killed or if they just died of neglect. And there's so many questions like that that so many families have experienced. What happened to my loved one? The Yazidi people there in the same region, of course, were even, if possible, suffered even more brutal treatment. A lot of their men were executed on site. Their women were sold into slavery, sexual slavery. Many of them are still held in Syria by the remnants of ISIS. And Yazidi families are still struggling to restore their women. They've kind of decided that the men must be dead at this point.
The Christians who fled, where are they now? Are they in refugee camps? Have they been resettled elsewhere?
Initially, they were in makeshift camps all over Iraqi Kurdistan, Dohuk, Erbil, any cities that had not been overrun by ISIS in that region. Other Christian communities were taking in people. They were very impromptu initially. In fact, the Archbishop's compound in Erbil, Archbishop Warda, at one point had hundreds of people living on the compound, especially the night of the great escape. I believe it was in August, right, if I'm getting my dates right. You know, thousands of people had to leave overnight, August 6th, I believe. And they had no idea where to go. There was no central government to appeal to for assistance. The Iraqi, the Kurds were not letting them through checkpoints. I mean, can you imagine? You got your whole family thrown into a car, or worse, you're on foot, and then you're at a checkpoint. You can hear the gunfire behind you, and you're not allowed to go any further. So eventually the Kurds, Peshmerga, let them through, and people just sort of landed wherever they landed. Within weeks, the church had responded and had gotten people into intermediary shelters. A lot of abandoned properties, semi-built buildings, suddenly became homes. People were just taking up residence wherever they could throughout Erbil. Over the last 17 months, people have begun to return. The air campaign and the Iraqi government's campaign against ISIS has driven them more or less. I have to, you know, it's still qualified. It's not clear, you know, how completely safe these areas are. Have driven ISIS first underground, quite literally. They dug tunnels everywhere. They even connected. They had tunnels that were kilometers long. Mm-hmm. And they connected cities so that they could travel without being observed by drones. So they're still finding these tunnels, and sometimes ISIS is still using these tunnels, so they can still materialize unexpectedly in places. But some Christians have been returning home to cities like Karakash, which they call Baghdida. The Assyrian Christians, the Chaldean Christians, call that Baghdida. This is sort of an indication of the complexity of the area. The Iraqi government has a name for it. The old Ottoman Empire name Karakash is still being used generally, but the Christians call it a different name based on their language and their history. There are some Shiites who live there, so they prefer the Turkish name, and the Christians want to change it to the Christian name, and that's going to be a giant. So the Iraqi government solved the problem by coming up with a third name, mm-hmm. which hardly anyone uses, but you know, there it is. So people have returned to Karakash, quite a few, and they're rebuilding everything that was destroyed either by Iraqi government helicopters, American planes, or ISIS mortar fire, or just outright, you know, as they retreated, they detonated Christian worship sites if they hadn't already destroyed them.
Right. Do they have now Christian worship sites to go to worship together?
Yes, they're starting to restore that. The church made a decision, the Nineveh Reconstruction Committee, with the church, the local church, decided that the first thing they wanted to do was restore as many homes as possible. It was low-hanging fruit, you know, which houses have been only partially damaged, which would require the least amount of effort to get back into a habitable state. So they moved through houses that were partially damaged to houses that were burned out, but the structure itself was intact. Houses that were completely destroyed, they may never get to, but they have restored thousands of homes. And now people in some villages, people are looking to restore the their churches that were either desecrated or demolished or very badly damaged. So that's beginning to happen. So I saw some restorations that were absolutely beautiful in a couple of the villages I visited. And it was very important to people. As the priest said, we didn't want to do this, but the people said, no, we need to have the church. We need to come back and see our church. The church, the main church in Karakash, which was badly damaged, I believe the roof was collapsed, people actually prefer to go to it in the state it's in now. So they've been having services, they've been having mass in the Karakash Cathedral. I think it's St. Mark, I could be wrong. So forgive me if I got that name wrong. But they're having it exactly as ISIS left it. And people are treating that quite reverently, actually, that this church is damaged like our Christian community was damaged. Our bodies, our houses were damaged, and it speaks to them to leave it. I don't know if they're going to continue to leave it like that, but that's how they've been going to worship there.
Wow. You mentioned that the Nineveh Reconstruction Committee yeah. wanted a fellow Christian journalist to come and see what was there and hear the stories. What were Christians telling you that they wanted, either from their fellow Christians or from the United States?
Well, they want things that I don't think people are prepared to give them, unfortunately. As a lot of people ask me, are the Americans going to come back? They want American soldiers on the ground. They do not trust, after what happened with the Peshmerga, they don't trust the Peshmerga to protect them any longer. They really don't trust the Iraqi central government. There's a Shiite militia that is taking up checkpoints all over the region now. The Hashid, they completely don't trust them. There's a lot of mistrust. They feel like no one's there to protect them. There's a rudimentary, it's called the Nineveh Protection Unit, a Christian military force, but it's really, I think it's maybe 1,000 soldiers, and it's really nothing. You know, no one wants to refer to it as, well, this is our militia, so now we're safe. No one believes that. And I think it could be very easily overwhelmed if circumstances turn south quickly again. Yeah, they want help with reconstruction. They also feel like the UN or the United States or Europe, somebody should be stepping in to protect them. And not just them. Like, there are other minority groups that have historically been badly treated in Iraq and that need protection now. The Yazidi, the Mandians. I don't know if you've ever heard of Mandians, but they're followers of John the Baptist. I mean, Iraq is just sort of like a museum of religion, of Eastern religions. So our religion is originally an Eastern religion. And you can find them all. The roots of them all are in Iraq, and some of them are deeply. I mean, if you had like a wildlife protection fund, these species of religions would be deeply, deeply endangered, and they'd be on protection lists.
I wondered if we could talk a little bit about your own expectations going in and how they were met or not. In a sense, you know, when you went. When you left, were you afraid? Were you excited? What did you expect to find there, and did you find it?
Well, I think it's fair to say, as I got on the 16-hour flight from New York to Doha, I really felt, wow, I'm just so too old for this kind of thing. The last time I went to Honduras, my dad was horrified, and he said, "You're too old. You're too old to do this. You have children. Can't go out and do field work." Now, this is a guy who was a New York fireman for 34 years. So
he knows something about danger.
Yeah.
But you do have kids, right?
I do have kids.
You have
kids,
four kids. You have a wife.
I did have to think about that.
And what did Megan, your wife, think about this?
Megan is very supportive of, I don't know if there's any subtext I need to worry about here, but she's always been very supportive. I was in Central Africa a couple of years ago, in Honduras during some unstable times last year. This didn't seem to faze her too much, especially after I told her we'd arranged to have insurance, you know, in case anything happened.
Right, so you've had some experience in difficult situations in reporting, and so how did your expectations differ this time?
Well, I was right off the bat upon arriving, you know, Iraq is very much a second world country. There's a lot of creature comforts that, you know, you might not expect to find there. I stayed at a perfectly nice hotel. The first thing that struck me as I got out of the cab was there was a giant statue of Our Lady in the traffic intersection, which I totally did not expect to see. I was it was explained that this district that I was staying in, Ankawa in Erbil, is about 90% Christian, and it is like by law it is 90% Christian. You can't buy property there unless you are a Christian.
Oh, interesting.
Because they're trying to offer assurance to Christians that they will have a safe place to live. Unfortunately, the byproduct of that is, of course, there's a great deal of segregation. Like just crossing the line into the Sunni neighborhood, you could almost feel the difference. But there was Our Lady just standing up in the middle of the intersection watching over Erbil and me. And I guess I felt a little more comfortable right off the bat. But it also speaks to the complexity of the problem there. Christians are leaving Erbil. Now, a lot of them have moved in from Mosul and Karakosh and other cities that were threatened by ISIS, so Erbil is relatively safer. They went there as refugees, internally displaced refugees, internally displaced people. But they restarted their lives there, and now a lot of them don't want to leave. You know, their kids are going to school, they've gotten jobs, they rebuilt houses sometimes. And Our Lady is watching over them there. Shia people want to move there too. Now, technically, they're not allowed to, because it's supposed to be Christian, so Christians can't sell to Shiite people. So they can only sell to other Christians. Well, Christians are trying to leave, in general, are trying to leave Erbil, so there's not a great demand for Christians to buy houses from other Christians or sell houses to other Christians. So they've concocted this bit of a scam where they just go to the local municipal authorities and say, this person owed me money, and to satisfy the debt, or I owed this person money, I'm giving him my house. And that is that they just sort of paper over the restriction.
Oh, interesting.
And this is something that worries the local Christian establishment. You know, it's another way that people can leave. You know, obviously, if you can't find a way to sell your property, you're more inclined to stay because you'll have nothing where you're landing. So it's just one other indication of the existential threat and the ways people are dealing with having so much uncertainty about their future. They're now in the safest part of Iraq, but they still don't feel safe enough to stay.
Right.
We talked about what the Iraqi Christians wanted from the West, from the U.S. What is the United States actually doing these days in Iraq to help the Christians or
there's
not?
There's a great deal of frustration about that. I heard from several church leaders that they hear lots and lots of promises. Vice President Pence was mentioned frequently, mm-hmm. who has been making various overtures. We're going to help the Christians. We're going to help the Christians. And, you know, their attitude now is put up or shut up. We need money. You know, we know that, you know, refugee numbers have been cut down to 30,000. There is no priority for Christians coming out of Iraq on those lists.
Are any coming out of Iraq
to the
U.S.?
Very, very few. I mean, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think, 30,000 is the global figure. Right. So maybe if there's 1,000 or 2,000, that would be significant.
But they're not on the banned list?
Generally, no.
Okay.
Iraq is, I don't know how they get around that or how they approach it. I mean, yeah, I think Iraq might be, or at least it's on the heavily vetted list. Yeah. So that's they know they're not going to get that kind of help. They're not going to get resettlement assistance. So they would love to get money to help them rebuild, rebuild their homes, rebuild their churches, rebuild their livelihoods. The economy there is on top of everything else that's going wrong, is in very poor shape. The political situation is very unstable. People are looking at the United States to, if they're not going to send soldiers and they're not going to allow us to leave, then send some money and help us to stay. The ones who are remaining, which I hasten to point out is a perilous few at this point.
Yeah. What role does the U.S. have in the current plight of Christians? Do we have a special responsibility because of our actions in the region?
Well, I think we do, yeah. I think... they have been blamed. They have been associated with the West. We're Christian. They're Christian. They had nothing to do with the decisions to invade Iraq that led to this regional instability. They felt safer under Saddam Hussein. You know, they felt like that was a giant blunder on the Americans' part and the English, the United Kingdom's government part to overthrow Hussein because that sort of unleashed this Pandora's box of Islamic extremism, that they are now the focus. You know, the focus is on them as collaborators, as Westerners. People say that they hear from their Muslim neighbors, why don't you just leave? You know, this part of the world is our part of the world. You can go live in Europe. You know, go live with the West. The West isn't accepting them, so they're in a very difficult spot. A lot of them have already moved to other Middle Eastern countries where Christian minorities have appear to be safer, Lebanon and Jordan among them, Turkey if they can, and Europe if they can. There's a lot of this sister I talked to had 8 siblings. Each of them was seemingly in a different country, United States, Australia, Sweden, Germany. She and one other sister were the only family members left in Erbil in Iraq.
So you took a number of really lovely photographs while you were there, and in some of them there's children that are looking, you know, like kids,
like children,
like kids do,
yeah.
Right? Just kind of happy and having a lovely afternoon. And I wonder if you can talk a bit about the experience of the children that you met there. Are they being, you know, do they have any opportunity for education? Are they being recruited for some kind of militia? Are they, you know, do they feel safe? Do they feel threatened?
Well, I think a lot of the kids that I talked to saw probably have seen things that no child should ever have to see. You know, they've seen people killed right in front of them. They've been driven from their homes. They've survived mortar fire. I mean, I was in West Mosul, which is now full of it's virtually all Sunni Muslim. Few Christians. Virtually none said they would ever consider moving back to West Mosul or even East Mosul, which is considered relatively safe. And there were kids playing on the streets, you know, among the ruins of this city. And we know that they were there during the worst of the bombardment to liberate the city from ISIS. You know, a lot of American bombs were dropped in that city, and a lot of civilian casualties were incurred. So I can only imagine the children that I saw happily playing really had a rough couple of years, something that I'll never have to experience. I saw some kids that were remarkably dressed for school and on their way to school walking through the utter ruin of West Mosul. They were, you know, this is a phenomenon I've seen in other places in Haiti, kids emerging from the worst sort of slums in absolute immaculate school outfits. And I'm thinking of my kids, I can barely get them to comb their hair in the morning. And these kids are, so I saw that same phenomenon. There's three little boys, their father taking them to school in West Mosul. They looked perfect. So some kids are getting back to school. Some kids, their education have been disrupted so badly that they'll never catch up again. So years, I mean, they haven't been going to school. Some of the children were living under ISIS, and their only education has been, as many people told me, they've been brainwashed for 3 years, and we're going to have to deal with that for a very long time. You know, how do you unravel these kids from what they've been taught and what they've experienced?
Right.
There's a lot of trauma psychologists at work in that part of the world right now.
Yeah. You were with Jesuit Refugee Service as well?
I was with Jesuit Refugee Services and Catholic Refugee Services, who all have programs there. JRS has some remarkable things going on with reestablishing education and providing psychological trauma care for people who've been through either displacement, combat, you know, have been through the worst.
So. Kevin, we have 2 minutes left. How can people help, right? We hear these stories. Is there anything that an average American can do to assist here?
Well, I think right off the bat, you can try to remember that, you know, years ago, Colin Powell told President Bush, if you break it, you own it. That was his sort of, the joke was the Amazon, whatever the joke was there, that the principle was that if you break something, you own it. We broke Iraq badly, and we have not followed through on the restoration. I know a lot of people want to get out of Iraq. We want to get out of Afghanistan, but we're going to leave a lot of people that we've made their vulnerability even more acute than it was before. So we have to think about that. So first, I would say, remember the Iraqi Christians, the Yazidis, and other minority groups. Tell your congressperson that you remembered them, and you expect that congressperson to represent their interests when funding is doled out and policy is made in the future. And then you can donate. CRS, JRS.
Catholic Relief Services,
Nineveh
Jesuit
Reconstruction
Refugee
Committee,
Services.
Aid to the Church in Need.
All very good. You can find out more about these organizations and our organization at americamagazine.org/serious. Thanks so much for being with us today, Kevin. Thanks, Colleen and Ashley. From all of us at America Magazine, we're wishing you a wonderful day.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.